Welcome to the House of Style podcast, a conversation series where we talk to prominent Australian interiors figures about their design journey, what inspires them, and where they're headed.
This is a deep dive into their past, present, and futures, discussing what it takes to become an iconic figure in today's interiors landscape.
With our background as style editors, we've crossed paths with some incredible furniture and homewares brands, designers, artists, and makers. This is our way to share their inspiring stories with you, the listener. I'm interior stylist Kerri-Anne Jones.
And I'm interior designer Jono Fleming. And welcome to the House of Style.
This is it. We have made it to the final episode of season 3.
Yep, and we have such a treat for you today.
Sure do. A couple of weeks ago, we went to the Rocks to the Ken Doan Gallery here in Sydney, and we sat down with Ken in his studio, and it was one of our favourite interviews yet.
I've got to admit, we're pretty quiet this episode. We don't have much to say because, to be honest, we were transfixed. We were at the edge of our seats the entire episode. Ken is such a beautiful storyteller.
We know Ken for his iconic illustrations of Sydney Harbour, the Australian landscape, beaches, the reefs. But what we didn't know was his entire career in advertising.
Ken lived in London, Tokyo, New York in the 60s, you know, that whole Mad Men era.
I know. And like jetting off to the Bahamas to shoot ads for Bacardi. That story was incredible.
Oh, yeah. Full James Bond stuff going on there. Absolutely amazing. This is a bumper episode, but you're not going to want to miss a single word that Ken has to say.
And right at the end of the episode, we have a special message from one of our guests from earlier in the season, and it's one of the most special moments that we've ever had recording this podcast.
I mean, what can you say about Ken? The man is an actual icon, he's the master of colour, and he's a bloody legend. So enjoy this chat with Ken, it's very special to us. And thank you so much for tuning in to Season 3 of House of Style. It's been really fun having you on this journey. And a little hint for Season 4, we might be seeing you on the road. Stay tuned. Really exciting. We are in the studio of the iconic Ken Doan here down at the Rocks. Just come down this morning to the gallery and we're sitting here with Ken. Thanks for joining us today.
It's a great pleasure to be here.
I think when we're thinking about colour and Australian creatives, you are definitely one of the icons.
Yep, definitely.
In both categories there.
So we like to take it back to the beginning with our podcast. Can you tell us about your upbringing and where you grew up and a bit about your childhood?
Okay. I was born in Belmore, when there were fields around the western suburbs and cows, and it wasn't very much like it is now. But Belmore was the center of the universe as far as a little kid is concerned. And I was born in 1940, which is the start of the war.
Yes.
I thought it might have been something I said. Anyway, it was an incredible time for Australia. My father was a bomber pilot, and he was overseas. I didn't see him until I was five. And so I lived with my mother and her sisters and my grandma in a house in Belmore. And it was, for me, a wonderful time. There were lots of parties. There were lots of servicemen coming and going. My uncle was an American serviceman who came in Australia and stayed. But as a boy, as a little boy, all I can remember is being surrounded by a lot of women, really, and the love and the comfort that came from that situation. When the war finished, it was 1945, and my father came back to Australia, I remember the day because my mother had very bad asthma and she was too sick to go out to meet him. And it was a very tense time. So I remember going with my grandparents and a couple of my aunts, and we went out to Bankstown Aerodrome, and suddenly I met this man called Dad. Well, I'd never met him before. And it was a strange situation.
Yeah.
I don't think it's unique. I think there were a lot of young Australian kids at that age when their parents came back, whether it's the mother or the father, from being in a war situation, suddenly you have to rebuild a family and you have to find where you all fit. And look, I loved my father, but at the start, I think it was strange for both of us.
Yeah.
He'd been, you know, in England flying bombers and, you know, I was a little kid colouring in. So he didn't want to stay in the city and we moved then from Belmore to a town on the Clarence River called McLean. And so that's really where I had my boyhood.
Yeah.
And I think that if you're a child, whether you're a boy or a girl, those years from 5 till 10 are incredibly important. They teach you a lot and they mold you a lot. So for me, McLean, it's on the Clarence River, flooding again today as we speak.
Yes.
We only had 2 floods when I was there in the 5 years. And as kids, we thought floods were great.
Yeah.
Great.
More water.
Great, more water, no school. Look, I remember once I was sitting with a couple of mates on the edge of the swollen river and we saw a dunny go floating past.
Oh,
I didn't think we would ever see anything in our life as funny as that. Absolutely cracked up. I'm sure it was very difficult for our parents with the houses. If you lived down by the river as we did, your house got full of flood mud. If you lived up on the hill, you overlooked it. But for me, it was an idyllic boyhood. I didn't have to wear shoes to go to school. I could go fishing before school, fishing after school, riding my bike, mucking around, no homework. I mean, I think nowadays in school, there should be a class that's just called mucking around.
Yeah.
When you're little, mucking around is one of the most, if not the most influential and creative time.
Absolutely.
And especially if you're an only child, as I was, you have to use your imagination to make up lots of things.
Yeah.
Now, you, again, both of you wouldn't know this, but the ABC, there's, of course, no television. That's a lifetime away. So there's the radio.
Yeah.
And the radio is about the size of a small refrigerator. It's a big it's a big thing in a wooden case.
Yes.
But the interesting thing about it, it's quite warm because there are big valves in it. So in the afternoon, if it was in the winter and it was getting dark, as a little boy, I would really sit right up close to the radio, touching it, because we didn't have any heating in the house. And the radio is quite warm. And I used to listen to a program on the ABC, which is called The Argonauts. Now, for people of my age, and there's probably still a few around in Australia, The Argonauts was very important. It came on at about 5:30. And it had all kinds of little stories and stuff going on. And the thing I like most of all is they had an art class, which is quite difficult on radio.
Yeah.
Anyway, it was an artist who actually turned out to be quite a famous artist. And he would set you various problems and you could send in drawings. So I remember I sent in 2 drawings of boats on the Clarence River. And to my great surprise and pleasure, they sent me back 2 gold stars. So I thought, well, you're onto something here.
Good at that.
So I'm good at that. But it was a wonderful boyhood. I was telling somebody the other day, the pictures, not the movies, we don't call them movies, that's American. The pictures were only on once a week on a Saturday. And on Saturday afternoon was a session for the kids. It's always serials and cowboy movies.
Yeah.
And so we would go to those, that afternoon's pictures. And then on Sunday morning, we would be whatever the cowboy was,
yeah.
right? So I would sometimes be Hopalong Cassidy or Tom Mix, and my mate Max would always be the Durango Kid. And so that's like 1946. Yeah. A couple of years ago, or maybe it was even last year, I was here in the studio and I was working. I was very busy, and one of the girls came in and said, "Oh, there's a man outside wants to see you." And I said, "Look, I'm just absolutely flat at the moment. Can you ask him to wait? I'll come out as soon as I can." So she came back in again, and she said, "He wants you to know that the Durango Kid is waiting outside."
Oh, that's like goodness.
I dropped everything, and of course we're not there. If you're the Durango Kid when you're six, you're still the Durango Kid. So McLean, the Clarence River, 1,000 great stories came out of that experience, and I just thought it was great.
Mm. So listening to that art lesson on the radio, was that the start of you being interested in art?
Look, it's a good question. I think like most kids, I was always drawing.
Yes.
It's like every single person in the world when they're young makes a mark on something. And from, say, 5 to 10, they are unbeatable.
Mm.
I'm not as good as a 5-year-old. I'm better than most 9-year-olds, and I can wipe the floor with anybody over 10, but I can't be as good as a 5-year-old. Mm. 5-year-olds come at it with a kind of freedom and an honesty and an enthusiasm, and they don't care. If they want to make somebody with some arms coming out of their head, well, why not?
Why not? My daughter, she's 6, and she has been obsessed with art since she could literally hold a pencil.
Good.
She's been drawing and still does. And
good.
It's amazing to see.
You know that you will never own anything as important as those drawings.
Absolutely.
That she's doing.
I can't throw them out.
No, of course you can't throw them. You end up with tons. Look, you've got to, in the end, you know, at some point in time, you do got to cull them a little bit.
I know. But I feel so guilty when I do that.
I know. But it's those drawings tell you more about how your kids feel about you and the world in general.
Mm.
It's when a child gets to be a young teenager that sometimes they think, well, I can't draw. What they mean is that they can't draw anything to represent. They can still draw the feeling of something, but logic starts to tell them that certain things have to happen in a certain way. And so they move on to something. Anyway, not everybody can be an artist. They're a very difficult job. It's a very complicated role. But I would always encourage people to continue to make some marks on something, especially in the time that we all live now, where everything can be seen and communicated on a screen in front of you. And most of the information that kids are taking in is coming from their phones or their iPads or stuff like that. I would still encourage using the hand and a pencil or a brush or a crayon, or it doesn't matter. Make a mark on something.
Yeah.
Make a mark on something. Yeah.
Yeah, it's so important. I mean, I used to teach at uni and teach design, and everyone just wants to get straight onto the computer and straight onto Photoshop and
have it done.
Put it that way and do their mock-ups. And I always just say to them, no, you have to hand in a sketch.
Yeah, because see something.
Also, when you're in front of a client, when you're in front of someone and you need to get an idea across, there's nothing quicker than pencil and paper.
Yeah, look, I mean, I can't be too much of a Luddite, because in the time in which we live, you have all of these fantastic devices to do all of these things. But I think it always starts, it starts with making a little mark and stuff. You can paint in Vegemite if you want to in the morning on your toast. You know, you can make a little shape. Depends whether that interests you.
Yeah. And so we did a little bit of, obviously, a bit of background research, and you left school at 14 to go to art school. That is incredibly young and amazing. Well, can you tell us about that?
I went to Mossman High, Mossman High School. It's a terrific school.
Yes.
But it didn't teach art to boys when I went
there.
Right.
Which, and now it has a very good
reputation. Because it's a very creative school.
It is now a very good reputation. But in those days, it didn't teach art to boys. And so I passed the intermediate, which is like the year equivalent of year 10.
Yeah.
You know, I was a comparatively smart kid. And I'd finished, you know, I'd passed the intermediate at 14. Most people pass it at 15 and then some of them leave school because you're not supposed to leave school until you're 15.
Yeah, okay.
Anyway, it's a complicated story, but I wanted to go to art school. I used to go to drawing classes on a Saturday morning. Mm-hmm. And the guy, like a little arts classes up in Gore Hill where the ABC was. Anyway, the guy up there said, said to my father one day, oh, your son should go to East City Tech, which is now the National Art School. Mm-hmm. Well, we didn't know anything about it. We didn't know anything about that. Anyway, we found out about it. And because I'd passed the intermediate, we went to, so I remember when my dad and I, we went to the education department in College Street and explained them. And they said, well, if I continued to study, then I could leave school. So I was then able to start at, which is now called the National Art School, at 14, where I was 14 and a half. Mm-hmm. I think I was the youngest one that ever started there.
I think you would have been.
Yeah,
I was. And, of course, more than anything, I wanted to see a totally nude woman. Well, I'm 14.
Absolutely.
I haven't seen one up to that point in time. And I'm ready.
Yeah.
I'm more than ready. Yeah. Anyway, it turns out that, you know, life class, you don't have a life class until your second year. In the second year when the first art class started, it was at 9:30. I was there about 20 to 7, basically.
You have to wait an extra year.
I'm ready.
You've been doing this for a year. Ready for your life drawing class.
Anyway, the girl comes in, takes off her clothes, and there's a series of quick sketches and then slightly longer sketches. And then finally, you know, there's a long pose that goes for about an hour. And the teacher comes around the outside and corrects the anatomy and looks over your shoulder and stuff like that. Anyway, never, ever, ever came and stopped by me. And I was really getting worried what was wrong because I could draw quite well and I couldn't work it out. Anyway, eventually came to me about 5 to 12 just before the class finished and he leaned over so the other students couldn't hear and he said, don't you think it's about time you attempted the head?
Oh, that's funny.
Oh,
it's all about the attention to details.
Yeah, there is something about the shoulders. Anyway, look, I was at art school for a few years and I enjoyed it. But and I think, like, if you're going to be a musician, for instance, the earlier you go to conservatorium, the better. Yeah. And the art school in those is fairly disciplined. Drawing, perspective, color, all of that kind of classical stuff, which I think is, even though you move past that, it's important. It's like if you're a pianist, you need to know where the notes are on the piano before you can be a jazz pianist. So that part is important. And so, yeah, I was glad that I did it. It was very important to me. But, you know, I didn't ever expect that I'd spend my life as a painter. I wanted to travel. And so that's another story. Yes. Ask me another question.
That's was going to be our next question.
So you went, because you sort of went traveling for a bit via sort of
when
to
I
New
left,
York.
When I left art school,
I was
offered, look, at the end of the fourth year, there was a really good art director here in the streets, dead known for it's called Arthur Holland. And he said that he would take the best student in the school as a kind of summer experience, work experience. Wouldn't pay him anything, but he would. So he chose me.
Show you the ropes.
So I went down there, and he was a great art director. And I remember he said to me one day, he said, can you do like cutout lettering like Matisse? I said, yeah, I can do that. And he gave me a word to cut out. I forget even what the word was. And he said, okay. Now, he said, I want you to draw a didgeridoo. But he said, draw it on blotting paper so it's got a kind of texture about it. And so I drew the didgeridoo. And then he got the cutout word and put it on top of the didgeridoo. It must have been something for an ABC program, because a week later it was on a 24-sheet poster in York Street. And that taught you the reality of the business.
Yes.
Of the business. Not mucking around doing a bloody, you know, can of smoked salmon in some, you know, the art school. You were out. You were in the business.
Yeah.
And so suddenly I was doing ads for Vogue. I was doing ads for British Motor Corporation. I was doing ads for the Wine Bureau. I had this a guy. There was a great old commercial studio in those days called Smith and Julius, and it was the last remains of those early commercial studios. It was down in Devonshire Street. Mm-hmm. Strangely enough, that's another story. anyway, they offered me £14 a week. I forget, that's not a lot of money, but
I would have been back then.
£14 a week, 1956, 7, something like that. Late 50s. Anyway, I was only there for 2 weeks because another guy who was the creative director of a good advertising agency offered me double that salary, so £28 a week. Please. And the real clincher, I could paint my office whatever color I wanted to paint it. So nice. I painted it purple, 1959. Nice. Purple, good color.
Yeah.
And so suddenly I was a young art director, you know.
Amazing.
And I was working. And once you're in the business, you know, you're responding to deadlines, you are solving problems, you are drawing, you're doing layouts, you're creating ideas, you have to understand the reality of communication. Somebody is paying you money for you to do something. And I liked it, I was good at it. I was good at it. Anyway, the guy who had that business decided to go overseas, so I took over. I took some of the people that were in that office, and I started my own little studio down in Sussex Street. And that was good too.
How old were you at that stage?
19, 20.
So young to be starting your own agency at 19?
Well, it was really a design studio.
Yeah.
But it was good. And, you know,
you were working.
Work. I was working. Amazing. I was working. And then I decided to go into business with a kid that I went to school with, a very old mate of mine who ended up being our best man at a wedding. He was a young art director at McCann Erickson's agency in Caltech's house. And we formed a little consultancy. I would have been 21 in Rose Street. Rose Street was the only street in Sydney in those days that had a lot of series of coffee shops. Only part of it exists. It goes from Pitt Street to Castlereagh Street. Mm-hmm. And the bottom half of it exists going up to where the Theatre Royal is.
Yeah.
But it was the only really little cosmopolitan street in Sydney in those days, and quite famous in the 30s and the 40s. So little coffee shops, little dressmakers, little things like that. In the middle was a tiny little tall building. On the ground floor, on the basement, you could look in. That sheet of glass, you could look in. It's like a sort of French shop. It was a very famous menswear shop. On the first floor was, again, equally famous coffee shop called The Galleria. It started by a guy called Mervyn Horton, who was the publisher of Art in Australia, the design magazine. On the next floor was a guy called Lloyd Lomas, a hairdresser in Double Bay, still does my wife's hair. And on the top floor was divided into two. The back was an English shirt maker from German Street, and Bob and I had the front office. And we sold concept and design to other agencies. A lot of people did it after that, but I don't think anybody else was doing it at that time. So you get a couple of bright young kids, we were. And we had, for instance, we had 2GB as an account, you know.
Yeah. Wow.
And we would do the concept and the word, and the pictures and the words, the copy and the things. So, again, it teaches you, especially if it's a media company that you're in. 2GB, I think it's back now to be the number one station, but in those days it was very much the number one station. And so you would be, you know, taking up copy and an idea. And there were two evening newspapers in Sydney in those days, the Mirror and the Herald. And so 2 days later, your ad would be in the paper.
Yeah, wow.
So you're moving. Over the years, I've done a lot of work for the ABC and I had Channel 9 as account for quite a while. And look, media is very interesting because they have to move so fast. And in the days that I was involved with Channel 9, it was before Kerry Packer took all of the bars and the refrigerators out of every very masculine environment in those days. But exciting.
Yeah.
I mean, thinking about Channel 9, I just remember there was an American program called Roots. It was a black cultural program, and it was an absolute world dominant program. So we had the problem. What are we going to program against Roots when it was coming out? So they decided they would run a whole program about Howard Hughes, the American entrepreneur. And I think we took maybe 6 consecutive full pages to try and combat Ruth to get kind of things. So I wrote the ads and I designed it. Bang, went one after the other. It's kind of a bit tits and bums, basically.
Yeah. Because,
you know, that's what Howard Hughes is using. I mean, I'm just doing my job. But we lost dramatically.
Mm.
So the media sometimes teaches you some harsh lessons that you can try and spend a lot of money to influence people, but, you know, you can't. Sometimes you'll fail. Yeah. Anyway, we jumped ahead about 30 years then. So go back to where were we? Where were we?
You were in Sydney.
We're in Sydney and about to go overseas.
Yes.
I went to Japan, first of all, with Bob. I like Japanese art. I like traditional Japanese art. I like the Japanese attitude to art. We had the opportunity to go and meet some young Japanese designers. And young Japanese designers were doing really contemporary, more contemporary things than America. They want if there was a Harley Davidson in Los Angeles decorated and a Harley Davidson in Tokyo decorated, the Tokyo one would blow it out of the water.
Yeah.
They took things to incredible extremes because it's not that long after the war. And so young Japanese designers, both men and women, were really, you know, punching a lot of things. That Izzy Miyake is starting to do amazing fashion. A very exciting place to be, Tokyo. And, of course, the Japanese attitude to art and design is very, very important. You know, you can make the most wonderful view out of a little tiny meter square garden if you have the eyes to look carefully.
And how long did you spend in Japan?
Only a few months.
Yeah.
And we came back to Australia.
Okay. Yeah.
And I was so enthralled about the concept of travel that I wanted to go again. Even most Australians went to England in those days because that was home. My parents are English, so, you know, it was to go to England that what young Australians did. I went to America. I went to Mexico. In those days, you could take a plane that went Sydney, Auckland, Tahiti, Acapulco, Mexico City, Bermuda, London. So I got as far as Acapulco. I stopped there. I've wound my way up the east coast of or the west coast of Mexico, up into California, into Los Angeles. I got freelance work in Los Angeles. I took a bus all the way across America to New York, and I was hired in New York by J. Walter Thompson. So it's a good experience.
Yeah.
Yeah. And how long did you spend in New York?
I couldn't stay there. I mean, a few months, but you had to. I'll give you a little bit about New York. When I arrived there, I had one introduction. I can't even remember how I got the introduction, but it was for a design firm. I went and I met this guy, 11 o'clock. We chatted. I showed him my work. He said, you know, once every 3 months, he said, all of the heads of design groups in New York, we have lunch at the Plaza Hotel. He said, it's today. Would you like to come to the lunch?
That was convenient.
Well, that was convenient.
Yeah.
So I remember I went to the lunch in the Plaza, right, obviously, and they're like Milton Glaser. I mean, there are important American designers all sitting around this table and me. And so I'd taken some of my work in my coat pocket. So if somebody said, oh, you know, pass the salt, something of mine will fall on the table.
Excuse me.
Yeah. Because you have to take the opportunity.
Yeah.
You have to take the opportunities it's not going to happen again. So the guy who sat next to me, a bloke called Rick DeFranza, nice man, he offered me a job. I said, I don't have a green card. He said, well, we'll just pay out of the petty cash. Obviously, they weren't paying me that much. Anyway, he had a design studio next door to the Rockefeller Center in New York. And so suddenly I found myself in this studio working. And what they liked most of all is that I could do lots of things, which is the Australian experience. They would say, you do a small illustration? Yeah, sure. You do an annual report? Yeah, sure. You do a post-it? Yeah, sure. So you could do lots of things because that's what you had to do in Australia. Mm. Whereas even in those days, and we're talking the early 60s, we're talking 60, I don't know, what, 62, 63, 64. Americans were quite specialized. Mm. If you did cars, you didn't do cars. You might do the tires. Somebody else would do the chrome, and then somebody else would do
really similar still nowadays.
Thing. Yeah.
Even I've talked to some friends who are stylists over there in Australia.
Yeah.
We'll build the set, we'll hang the light, we'll paint everything.
Yeah.
And in America, they're like, no, this is
somebody else's job.
Everyone has their own specialized thing.
Yeah.
And if you come in and do all of the stuff, they get a bit threatened because.
Yeah, I'm sure that's why they like making movies in Australia, because the crew know what they're doing.
Yeah.
And they haven't got too specialized. So anyway, I couldn't stay in New York because I couldn't get a green card. I was offered a job as art director in Thompson's in New York. Each art director could design their office the way they wanted to. It was very much the time of Mad Men.
Yeah.
It's that amazing. It's that era.
Yeah.
Like the guy in the office next to me. I mean, when I arrived there, they said, showed me the office. It's a big office. It's got leather couches, more leather couches than I've got here in this room. They said, you're going to be on the Ford account. Well, I am mechanically illiterate. Right? But you don't tell them that.
Of course not.
And what I was responsible for a very brief period of time was a thing called the Ford twin I-beam axle. To this day, I have no idea.
What is that?
I didn't like it. It adds for it. I have no idea
yeah.
of what it is or what it does. But, you know, you can wing it for a while.
Yeah.
The guy in the office next to me, who obviously likes sailing, he had a fake wooden floor. He had a ship's wheel. He had models of ships. He had a little bar. He only was just short of wearing a bloody, you know, sailor's cap. But that's what you could do in America in those days. That's how ridiculous the advertising. But tough business. Mm. Anyway, I couldn't stay there, so they asked me whether I'd go to the London office. And I hadn't been to London. And I said, well, I'll just go and see. Anyway, I went to London. I had an offer from Ogilvy Mather, an offer from Thompson's. Thompson's offered more money.
Yeah.
I took them. And I was very glad that I did. J. Walter Thompson in those days, biggest agency in London, very, very successful. When I first arrived, they said, well, this is the guy you'll be working with. He'll be the writer. You'll be the art director. This funny, weedy-looking guy with slightly poppy eyes. Anyway, it was a lovely bloke. We worked together for him. It was Dylan Thomas's son, Llewellyn. I eventually convinced Llewellyn to come to Australia, but that's another story altogether. So he and I worked in London for 5 years. We won the Cannes Gold Lion for the best cinema commercials in the world.
What?
1969.
Wow.
I had the Bacardi account. I convinced them we should shoot it underwater. Like I did the first ads for Bacardi. The Bacardi was had little black and white ads with little figures, Scottish cartoonist called John Blashan. Anyway, the first Bond movie had come out.
Yeah, that's right,
in Nashville. And I said, look, Bacardi should be about the sensuality of, you know, the tropics and all of those things that you expect it to be now, but in those days it wasn't. So I designed a couple of ads of a deal with Coke, a bottle of Bacardi in a coral head with a bottle of Coke, two people swimming down, and it was like Bacardi. I said, what? They said, can you do it? I said, I'm Australian. Of course I can.
Yeah.
Of course I can do it. Well, two things. I'd never been scuba diving in my life. I've been snorkeling. And they said, well, you could pick up a model in Nassau. You can find. I said, no, I'd just been married to Judy. Oh, wow, she's a beautiful girl. I said, no, I reckon Judy and I could do it. And so we learned to swim in the White House Hotel, which is Regent Park. We flew to Nassau. We rented a boat. We dived two or three times. A big storm came. You have to wait another two or three days before the water clears up. And you need to find a Nowadays, you could do this in a backyard in Chatswood with a bloody computer.
Totally.
Right?
Yeah, yeah.
In my day, you had to do it.
Yeah.
You had to find a coral head that's no more than a meter from the surface, so there's enough light coming down. You have to get a tin of sardines and jam it into the coral head behind the Bacardi bottle, stab it with a knife so oil is coming out to attract the fish.
Yeah.
You got to do it for real.
Yeah.
And then you got to have two people diving down to get
grab them.
I'll show you. It's in this book. Oh, I'll show you a picture of it in a minute. And then on the very last day, I knew because we were processing a little bit of the film at night in the motel in Nassau because you can't go back to London, and so I couldn't do it.
Yeah.
You have to do it.
Yeah.
You have to do it. And the deal was we were to fly to Bermuda on the way back, where the head of Bacardi family lived in a house fairly predictably called Bacardi and the Rocks, a beautiful house down there, and show them the work, which we did. We flew to come back a little bit. On the last day when we did the – second last dive, I still knew we didn't have the picture. It wasn't quite right.
Yeah.
So I said, we have to go down again. Well, you're not supposed to dive, you're not supposed to go down with another tank. I had no alternative. We went down again. One of the assistants that was down there suddenly ripped his mask off and had to be assisted up to the surface. We kept shooting. We finally got the picture. We came up. We got in the car. We went back to the motel. We went straight to the airport. We got on the plane. We're flying to Bermuda. And Judy, my wife, can't breathe.
She can't breathe.
Jeez.
So we get to Bermuda. Saturday night in the Princess Hotel. It's a very grand hotel. Judy still can't breathe. I said, well, it's got to be the bra. Your bra is too tight. With all the understanding, the sympathy of a jerk. And I said, give me that bra. I'm going to rip it in half. You cannot rip a bra in half. You have to be much stronger than I'd ever be. You can't do it. Anyway, I have to call the doctor. A doctor eventually comes and I don't know, I shouldn't have laughed, but it's like 1 o'clock on a Sunday morning because he'd been to a party and he comes in. He's wearing Bermuda shorts. Of course he's wearing Bermuda shorts. You're in Bermuda.
They just call them shorts there.
That's right. Anyway, he understands, you know, what the problem is and Judy has to rest. There's nothing he can really do about it. Anyway, we go back to London. The end of the story, I think, should be this. Each year, because of the success of that, we could go somewhere else.
Wow.
We came back to Australia. We shot in Barrier Reef. We went to Portugal. Wow. We shot there. You can do anything in the business if it works.
Yes.
And if it's really good,
it's successful.
You can continue to do. And, of course, it's a fantastic experience.
Yeah.
And I've been diving or snorkeling now for my whole life and I make so many paintings about the feeling of, you know,
in the reef.
What it's like to be under the water.
Yeah.
So I liked the business.
Yeah.
I was good at it.
You were great at it.
Well, then when we eventually left England and came back to Australia, I was still in the business. I worked for J. Walter Thompson. I took over Bryce Courtney's job. He was the head creative director. I became the creative director, which is usually the role of a writer. But I think, you know, whether it's an image or words, you're communicating and you're solving a problem that can come from. Anyway, you might have heard this story before, but it was on a Sunday. We were on holiday, Judy and I in Vanuatu, Sunday night. I was talking to the late Peter Brock, the racing car driver. He was there with his girlfriend. And he was talking to me about how passionate he was about racing car driving. And I realized I was good at advertising, but I wasn't passionate about it.
Yeah.
And so I flew back to Sydney. I walked into the chairman's office Monday morning and I resigned.
Wow.
Because I realized if you're going to be an artist, you had to give it everything.
Yes.
You had to give it everything. So we had one child. We had a house in Mossman. We had a big mortgage. I was 35. I had to find out whether I could support us, you know?
Yeah.
So for the next 5 years, I did freelance work as well as painting. And I used to always start painting on a Monday. I used to go down to the studio on a Monday morning. Mm-hmm. You have to discipline yourself to work.
It's funny you say that. We were chatting with Louise Olsen last week and she was saying the same thing. Mm. We asked her, you know, what was her father's advice, and it was about discipline, about your art, you have to have discipline.
Yeah, and especially if you come from a situation where I did, where you're surrounded by people telling you how clever you are or clients liking your work to working totally on your own.
Yeah.
Totally on your own. Just me and the dog, basically. I go down to the studio on Monday morning and I would work. But I needed to do some freelance work too because I needed some money.
Mm.
I needed to support us. So that's why I was 40 when I had my first exhibition.
Wow.
40. And I'm only 42 now, so I can't believe I've had so much.
You've done so much in just such a small time.
2 years. In these last 2 years, unbelievable. No, I'm 80. Christ, how does that sound? So that was the first exhibition and, you know,
and ever since
that leads to lots of other things.
So we're moving into the 80s now and you had your first exhibition and I read that you had 12 T-shirts printed up for the press at that exhibition.
Yeah, a simple drawing of Sydney Harbour. And even when that first exhibition, which was at the, it's not there anymore, but it was the Holdsworth Gallery. Holdsworth Gallery is the most biggest successful commercial gallery in Sydney in those days. So I had that exhibition. I made 12 T-shirts to give to the press, really, to remind them. Anyway, it's a very, I think she's dead now, a very good writer called Marion von Adelstein, who was the main writer on Vogue. And she wrote a piece. She said, look, you know, you can hang a donut on the wall or a donut on yourself. There's an integrity to everything you touch. So I was very flattered by that. And, you know, suddenly people wanted. Yeah. You made something. You repeated the singular effort. Mm. Draw it once, print it lots of times. We're still selling that design. That design still sells. And that expand. And even that exhibition was in June. By September, I think, I had opened my own gallery. I always knew that I wanted to do that. Because, as again, it's...
Must be such a big achievement.
It's
as,
like...
As an artist.
No different from a chef owning a restaurant.
Exactly. Yeah.
You can open your own magazine. You can do your own film, you know.
Yeah.
Nowadays, your generation can take a lot more control. Mm. And I'm not saying it's good for all artists and a lot of artists, but I do get slightly, not annoyed, nothing annoyed, but when a lot of or some of the younger artists say to me, oh, I don't want anything to do with business. I'm an artist, you know.
Yeah.
Well, come on.
Yeah.
Unless you've got very rich parents or you've got a government grant, you have got to find a way of surviving.
Exactly, yes. Yeah.
And, you know, the Japanese, for instance, they admired the fact that I could do a lot of commercial things.
Mm.
They respected that. Even those early koalas, you know, which I've said it before, but I mean, I could draw a koala so cute that 9-year-old girls would faint by their very cuteness. Well, that's what you set out to do.
Yeah.
I mean, that even led me at one stage, I was asked to go to Disneyland to talk about, you know, working on some Disney characters. Well, I don't want to do that, but it was very nice to be.
Yeah.
Very nice to be offered. It's funny when you go to Disneyland and you arrive at the front gate and, of course, you have to, you know, you're expected, you know, you stop at the gate and the guy says, you know, do you know where to go? Because I was going to the art department. I said, no, I don't know where to go. He said, right. You go down Dopey Drive, you turn at Cinderella Place, then you go to the Three Pigs roundabout. I mean, it's all Disneyland.
Yeah.
And of course it is. Where were we? Yeah, so I opened my own and there was a magazine called Billy Blue, again, before Smart Magazine, aimed at architects, designers, all of that. And they wanted me to do covers. So I said, I'll do the cover in exchange for some advertising space.
Yep.
So the advertising space I used to promote the T-shirt. Mm. I had a little gallery in North Sydney. I called it the Art Director's Gallery because I wasn't ready to call it the Ken Doane Gallery because there are quite a few art directors both in Sydney and Melbourne doing some good things and I would show their work. And I would, every time I did a Billy Blue cover, I would exchange it for advertising space because you need to reach people.
Yeah.
You, I guess having your advertising background, you really understood how to try and commercialize.
I understood that. Yeah. But it wasn't a trick. I mean, no. Sometimes people come in to interview me or talk about things and they'll say, well, did you have a PR group or is there a – there's no trick.
No.
You have to make something that's good.
That's right. Yeah, well, that's how it starts.
If you make something that's good, it'll lead to other things.
Yeah.
But you certainly have to show people what you can do.
Absolutely.
And so, you know, the T-shirts led to I realized you can't be in North Sydney. You have to be where people are. Mm. So I saw an ad for a little art. It was called the Arabia Gallery in 123 George Street. Anyway, that's another long story. Anyway, I got the lease of the little shop.
Yeah.
And so we were doing T-shirts, sweatshirts, Harriet. Flat things. This is not fashion. This is something flat. I can do this. This is flat.
Yeah.
Flat. So we had the T-shirts and the flat things downstairs, and I had a few pictures upstairs. That led to young Japanese girls coming to the shop more than any other singular group. And young Japanese girls in those days, it was tradition that they would buy lots of gifts for other people back in Tokyo. So they'd come and buy. We had to restock the shelves over and over and over because they would take a lot of stuff back to Tokyo.
Yeah.
And so when they get off the plane in Tokyo and they're carrying a Kendone bag, the people from the biggest magazine company in Japan got in touch with me because they see something's happening. They called, will I do the Hanako logo? It's a magazine that ended up in a circulation of a million a week. Had my artwork on the cover every week for 13 years, which is one of the reasons I became very well known in Japan. I've had exhibitions. I had an exhibition in Japan. 200,000 people went to see it, went to seven different cities. It did not receive one sentence in an Australian newspaper.
Wow.
It's just kind of a bit narrow, isn't it?
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Anyway, we move on from that. But making something that was good leads to other things. So, first of all, it leads to exposure in Japan. Then you get American people wanting to license. Then you get Japanese people wanting to license. Licensing is very simple. You have to A, want to do it, and B, trust the people.
Yeah.
Yes.
A lot of times it's the second part that falls down for young people because artists like to work. Well, like people say, oh, yeah, I'll do that. And businessmen often think, oh, they're an artist. We'll give them a couple of bottles of beer, they'll like that. Artists should make at least as much as plumbers.
It's a
business.
Absolutely.
So the two major licensing arrangements that I had, one in Japan, one in America, both went for about 7 years and both were very successful. You don't make a lot. Like in America, you might make say 5% of the wholesale price of something. So not much.
Not much.
But you need it. You need to turn it over.
Yeah.
And then in America, you're making things under license. I would fly to America. I'd get off the plane. I'd be working the minute I hit the bloody desk, you know. I'm not unhappy about it. It was my choice to do that. And so we had work in Bloomingdale's and Neiman Marcus. We had lots of stuff happening. Americans are very good at litigation. We were shamelessly knocked off sometimes. Like I'd put in a design, somebody would knock it off. My licensee would take them to court.
Goodness.
They're good at that.
Yeah.
And then they wanted me to do logos for lots of American cities. So I, I, you could design an alphabet that looks like California.
Yes.
So once you have an alphabet that looks like California, you can do Santa Barbara, you can do San Diego, you can do all of that. You can do that. And you can put it on stuff. You can put it on stuff. And then they wanted me to do Midwestern things. And I remember I got to do I'm an appalling speller. I got to have to do Albuquerque. Oh, I thought, too hard. Too hard. And I don't want to do it anymore. And that's, you know, even when I went to Disneyland, America's like a giant ball. It's really, really hard to get it started. And once you get it started, it has a different kind of life. And people would call me from Chicago and say, look, Brown is very big in Chicago. What are you doing in Brown? I'm not doing Brown. I'm not interested in Brown.
It's not my thing.
It's not in my head. Brown. Yeah. So you're being driven, which is okay. You can't pretend that you didn't like it. You can't pretend that you didn't want to do it, because at the time I did.
Yeah.
But then there came a time I didn't want to do it. It was too demanding. It's like that one little shop in Sydney Harbour, it led to 15 shops.
Wow.
And mostly that is because I'm quite good at delegating things.
Mm.
If I don't want to do it, I'll get somebody else to do it. Why don't you do this? Why don't you do this? Why don't you do that? Because I'm going in. Yeah. I'm painting. So when it got to 15 shops, we realized we could have shops all the way around the world if you wanted to. It's not that complicated. It means you have to have meetings.
Yeah.
You'd have to talk to people.
Well, you've also come from 20 years of this job where you're doing all of these things and then you finally let go of that.
Yeah.
Went to do something for yourself.
Yeah.
And just out of the success of what you were doing, you end up almost in the same place again.
That's exactly right. I have to overcome that success. You had to overcome it because it was so demanding. And even though you might have been able to do it, it's not what you wanted to do.
Yeah.
And there's not enough time. There's not enough time, unless you've got another, like another 4 or 5 lives. No, you can't.
You just can't do everything.
You can't do everything, even though you know in the back of your mind you could. But so what?
Yeah.
So what? Anyway, I didn't want to do it. We concluded the American license, and it's quite hard to conclude a license if it's successful. They want you to keep doing
it. Why would you stop now?
Yeah, why do we stop now? Hey, you guys, everything's good. The Japanese one was a different one because there's a lot of, I was going to Kyoto one day, and I got on the plane. I was taking a car to see the president of this company that we were dealing with. And I had them stop the car because we went past a shop, had my name big in the window, and I went and had a look inside. And it was kind of our stuff, but not really.
Yeah.
If you're going to do it, you have to control all of the parts of it.
Yeah.
You can't just let some parts go. And fortunately, the president of that company was also liked painting, Mr. Teshigahara. And I had the meeting with him and I said, look, I want to spend the rest of my life painting, which he understood. So there wasn't a kind of loss of face about concluding the business. Anyway, we don't have any licensing arrangements. And also what happens, and you're probably aware of this, if you do something that's really popular at the start, people love it. People say, oh, this is fabulous. We can't get enough of this. And then they start to see more and more. And then they think, oh, wait a minute. Because we were knocked off a lot. We were lots of stuff in Australia. If it was colour, I thought, shit, it must be Ken Durns. Well, no, it's not. No,
yeah.
But it gets to the stage where people say, I don't want to see that stuff anymore. That is awful. take it away. I'm about to be sick. And then it's quiet for a while. And then another generation comes and sees it. And they say, gee, that's really good. And that's where we are at the moment, you know?
Yeah.
Younger people understand it. They love it. We've got lots of people wanting to do this, wanting to do that. Maybe some we will, maybe some we won't. I don't think you go around a third time. I think you go around twice probably. Mm. And we are fortunately going around twice.
Yeah.
A lot of people drop off and never. So I'm very grateful for the fact that young people like what we do.
Well, I think we all grew up in the 80s with the T-shirts and the bed sheets and bed all sheets. Of it. And, you know, now those people, us, we're coming back around with kids and families
back
and homes and your own places, and you want to pull all of that nostalgia that you had as your childhood in.
Yes, well, that's certainly what we're feeling and the way that people are responding. I'm very flattered by that. And I think that your generation, it's of a different kind where you can see art and design and communication in all kinds of areas. What you're doing, I mean, this is an amazing thing that YouTube put this together, and you don't own a radio station. You're just doing it. No, that's not right.
But this season we are talking about colour, and your work is so – colour is such an important element in your work, and it's so iconic, and it's inspired by Australia and nature and the world we live in. What – it seems redundant to ask what inspires you when it comes to colour, but I guess I think when people think of Australia, they think of all the sort of earthy, red, dusty tones, but your work is always so vibrant and colourful and blue and –
Some critics said, he took the beige out of Australia. All colours are good.
Yeah.
Only like notes on a piano. Mm-hmm. It depends which note you put beside. Mm-hmm. If you put pink beside orange, it's a wonderful feeling. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I'm old enough that when I was a kid, there were people would say blue and green should never be seen. I mean, what a load of crap. Blue and green should never be seen. How amazing that there should be a little saying about colour.
Yeah.
And the colour has always been there. In your grandma's garden that's full of pansies and gerberas, you'll find the most amazing. You can't find better colour on the inside of a pansy. No, absolutely stunningly beautiful. I think it was because maybe at the time of the bed linen, when there wasn't anything around, suddenly I did some big colourful bed linen because I treated it like a big painting.
Yeah.
And a big area like that makes a big change to a room. So we get a lot of feedback that a lot of people have responded to that. But I like yellow very much. But in saying that, I like blue very much.
That
I like purple very much.
That's
going
to be my next question. What's your favourite colour combination?
Well, I wouldn't say it's a favourite colour, but I like yellow.
Yes.
I think yellow is a very...
That's been a common colour,
It's a
colour,
great
actually,
colour.
Yeah.
That we've been... people have said.
Yeah, it's a great colour. It's a very optimistic colour. And also, it's the Australians have already decided that yellow is our colour. I mean, in any sporting situation, you always see
That's
yellow
true.
As
yes.
being the dominant thing for Australia. And also, I like it because it's just on the edge of madness too.
Yeah.
It's just because, I'm often on the edge of madness. But equally so, soft mauve and grey can be beautiful.
Yes. Mm.
Even that painting behind you where I've made the table mauve, because it's not really mauve. In real life, that table is white.
Yeah.
And so I'm using that bit of mauve and the little bits of brown behind, that's just a piece of music, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's the song.
Yeah.
That's what you're singing. That's it's such a personal thing to look at a painting. You know, it's a private thing. Yes. I like to make paintings that are beautiful, whether they're bright or soft. But I want the paintings not to give you everything on the first viewing. Mm-hmm. If they're good, I want them to continue to please you.
Yes. Yeah.
I'm sure in your house you've got things that you love and you look at them all the time. You've got others that you don't look at them anymore, just out of the corner of your eye, you know. And with your kids, they're producing new things all the time to surprise you.
Yes.
Well, the artist can't quite do that. Somebody buys a painting, which I'm always very flattered, and I love to see it in somebody else's house because it's now got a different role and a different life. And even if I go to an exhibition, there's a big traveling exhibition of mine at the moment, and so it goes to different regional galleries and they always hang it in a slightly different way,
of course,
which is interesting to see the relationship one about the other. And look, here's maybe an end for you. Every time you have a big exhibition, there's always a book where people write things in. And not so long ago, I had a big exhibition in the Tweed Regional Gallery. It's full of reef paintings and paintings as good and as beautiful as I can make them. And, of course, you always want to read what people have written in the book. But you can't run over when there's lots of other people in the gallery and look at it. You know, it's a bit of a giveaway. So I remember in this case, I waited till there wasn't so many people. I went across and I looked. 99% of all of the comments are, you know, my mum could have written them. They're fantastic. And you think, well, you know, people with good taste and style, thank you very much. But you occasionally remember the ones that are not so congratulatory. And there was a terrific one in this exhibition from a girl who signed herself 10-year-old girl from Woolloomba. And she had written, really, Ken, I can do better paintings and I'm still in primary school. Oh. Next time, try harder. She's right. Brilliant. No, but she's right on two counts. I can't do better paintings than kids in primary school. I'm always trying harder.
Yeah.
Always trying harder.
Amazing. And everyone's a critic at every age.
Yeah. So it's a journey.
Yeah. And what is it about your work that you think people connect with? What do you think it is?
Well, I want them to love it.
Yeah.
And so what I've put into it, hopefully, is to give people pleasure out of looking at something.
Yeah.
I don't, even though, you know, I've been the Goodwill Ambassador to UNICEF for 30 years and I've been to refugee camps and seen horrific things, I don't make paintings about that.
Yeah.
Because I think painting is not the medium to use. I think television is the medium to use that. And, of course, each night, I've said this before, and you're watching the news each night, you can see horrific things, you know, while you're sitting there having your dinner. I think the role of painting is about more like poetry, to give you pleasure over time.
Yes.
For you to find more things in it.
Yeah.
To be beautiful. All of those words that somehow over the last 10 years in some art circles are not used, but I like them very much. I like the word beautiful. I like the word pretty. I like the word decorative. I think, well, that's fine.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Well, moving, we sort of head towards the future, but we also look back a bit and we've done a lot of looking back to the past, but is there any advice you'd give to your younger self?
At 80, the only advice you could do is to do some things more slowly. Mm. And I'm not going to elaborate on that.
Yeah.
You know, we're also used to, especially now, growing so fast, you know, trying to, in slow. All areas of our life, that we do just forget to slow. Stop.
Yeah. Mm. No, I wouldn't change. Look, at 80, and I've been married for like 130 years now.
Yeah.
Maybe not 130. But certainly, you know, Judy and I may be together maybe 60 years. In any lifetime, you're going to have lots of hills and valleys.
Yeah.
No one escapes that. No one. Doesn't matter who you are, there'll be depths of sadness you never thought you'd experience, and there'd be highs that you never thought you'd experience. So life's somewhere in between that. You know?
Yeah.
So you just, if you wake up and you live in Australia, you are already blessed. It's already,
Absolutely.
Live in Sydney beside the harbour. Well, get on with it.
Yeah.
What are you worried about? But Australians, as Australians, we're very lucky.
I mean, the last year alone has shown how lucky we are.
That's right.
In this country.
That's right.
And, you know, we're sitting here by the rocks
on a
beautiful sunny day.
Right now, yeah. To be sitting here with you.
If we could just knock down the overseas terminal, we could see the opera.
It'd be a great view.
So, looking ahead, what's on the cards for you?
I've got a number of exhibitions. I've got a big one in Casula Powerhouse. I've got one that's a new gallery in Barrel that Ben Quilty's been involved in putting together. Yeah. I've got this travelling exhibition that's travelling to various parts of Australia. I've got a trip to Ningaloo Reef in next couple of weeks to swim with the whale sharks. I've got a trip planned to go around the Black Sea, hopefully if it's safe next year. I've got lots of travel and lots of great things to do, and all I can hope is that I'm healthy and my family's healthy and I can continue to make paintings.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't need anything more than that.
No slowing down.
No, speeding up.
Yeah.
As you get older, as you get older, you should take more risks.
Yeah.
More risks. In my studio, in my big studio at home, I've written the word a couple of times, paintings for me. And recently I wrote the word fearless, because you have to be fearless.
Yeah. Yeah.
You get better at editing.
Yes.
I'm harder to please now with my own work. And I often paint over things that I don't think are good enough. And in fact, in my new book, if we are plugging that,
yes,
we'd love to chat about
there's
that.
A new book, you'll see that there's a painting in there which is called 10 Paintings Painted Over. And so often I will paint over. It's very important, I think, that you destroy some works.
Yeah.
If it's not good enough, if you don't like it.
Yeah. You'll just never be happy with it.
Yeah,
absolutely.
And so the new book, tell us about that.
The new book, Thames and Hudson, big art book. I think this is about the fourth or the fifth book that we've done, but this is a very important one. It's called Art, Design and Life, and dealing with those three things. So there's lots of paintings, there's lots of design, and there's a bit about life, or my life and Judy's and my family's. But I think it's important. A lot of the times people would talk about my work and lump it all together. Some of it is design.
Yeah.
Some of it is art.
Right.
Design has a defined audience and you can measure its effect. Did you sell any more copies of the magazine, you know?
Yeah.
With design, you know who you're aiming it at. Doesn't mean that you get it right every time, but if you design something and if you have a shop to put it in, you can work out quite swiftly, does it work? Or if you are a young artist or a young designer and you do some T-shirts and you put them in a little stall in a local market, you find out very quickly, does that work or not? So I just want people, well, I don't want, I don't want anything, but I hope that a book like this makes people understand the difference between art and design.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I love that.
And two really sort of important parts of your life and career as well.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
Well, I think that takes us to the end. At the end, we do fast five questions.
Right.
So just some short, sharp answers.
Sure.
So the first question is...
Yeah, let's see if you can give a short, sharp answer to this one.
This is going to be a tricky one for you, I think. What is your career highlight? One career highlight.
I reckon the work I did for the Olympic Games, because that's like the closest I'd get to painting for Australia.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Absolutely. What music do you listen to when you paint?
Everything from Jerry Lee Lewis to Ray Charles to James Morrison, loud, fast, and anything.
Love that.
B.B. King.
Yes.
Cool. And what is the best beach in Sydney?
Well, I live at Chinaman's Beach. It's no secret. I think it's the best beach in Sydney.
Cool. Fair call.
Yeah. Chinaman's Beach.
That whole area. Just around Mossman and all those little ocean beaches that are all around there.
Yeah. Chinaman's Beach is particularly beautiful. I wanted to change its name to Shark Infested Funnelweb Bay, but unfortunately they won't accept it, so it's Chinaman's Beach.
Do you have a favourite spot to eat in Sydney?
Look, as we hear in the Rocks is a great example of a collection of fabulous restaurants. There's the Key restaurant, probably one of the, you know, best restaurants, not in Australia, in the world. There's a terrific Japanese restaurant and the top of the overseas, Tomoko Yuki's, and all along the front in Campbell's Cove, wonderful restaurants. There's a little Korean restaurant we eat up there, fine food. It's a great concentration of restaurants here in the Rocks.
Right? Yeah, awesome. And the final one, dream holiday destination.
Look, there's not a continent that we haven't been onto. We've been to the South Pole. We've been into the North Pole. Wow. We have been traveling constantly all our life. I don't have any real dreams.
What's your favourite destination?
We've been 30 times to a tiny island off Fiji called Tombarua. It's only 4 acres. It's not very fashionable. It's not very smart, but we like it very much.
Nice.
Amazing. Cool. Now, as one final thing, I do have a special love letter from one of our previous guests this season, Julia Green from Greenhouse Interiors. We asked her on her episode, who's your favourite artist? Who you want to collaborate with one day? All of those sort of things. And she said, didn't even let us finish. It was Ken Doan. So I said to Jules that I'd read this out to you. Dear Ken, we met a million years ago in the suburbs of Melbourne. I was only 10 years old and you were my first true colour love. I felt like we spoke the same language, even though I was just a kid, and you were on my Duna cover for 5 years straight. I spent every penny of my hard-earned money on your wares. I proudly coveted and owned them all, from linen and posters to wine coasters that I'd bought for my mum when I could hardly afford to. I snapped it all up and cherished
all that you put your name to.
My whole family did. And now I'm nearly 50, and it's kind of funny to say nothing's changed. Except now I style and write for magazines and am known as a stylist for her love of colour and in championing art in Australia. And when I'm regularly asked who is my idol, I say you, every time, always have, always will. A heartfelt congratulations on your stellar, unparalleled career and for championing colour in our country. I'm the head of your fan club, Julia Green.
Thank you. Make me cry.
Making me cry.
Yeah, that's lovely.
Yeah.
Lovely. I hope I meet her one day.
Yeah, she is a very wonderful woman. And look, I think we need to wrap it up there. This has been amazing. We've done 3 seasons of this podcast now. I don't think we have ever had a guest quite like you.
Thank you.
And I've been on the edge. We've been on the edge of our chairs the entire time. We could talk for
such a joy.
Yeah.
Good. Well, lovely questions. Lovely to be with you too.
Yeah.
Thank you.
This is modern times, isn't it?
Yeah.
To be able to reach an audience like that.
And I'm just so excited to share more of your story that people may not have heard and go down memory lane for those who have. So, yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ken, for joining us on this episode of House of Style. Don't forget to check out Ken's new book, Ken Doan, Art Design Life, by Amber Creswell Bell. It's filled with beautiful images and a lot that relate to the stories that Ken told on this episode. You can find us on Instagram at House of Style Podcast. We'll be keeping you updated on what we're up to and what's coming for season 4. Don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe and tell your friends. And we'll see you soon back here on the House of Style.
House of Style is powered by Logitech and Blue Microphones. Thank you to Lucy Stevens for our artwork, Pro Podcast Productions for our audio, and Samantha Ponton for our social media.